Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 672 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Top Cow Chronology episode, and today I'm going to be talking about Arcanum number 1. It's a Top Cow title that came out in the 90s. It's written by Brandon Peterson, handling the pencils as well. And then we have a lot of inkers. We have Bat, we have Art Taber, Sean Parsons, Hack Shack Studios, Tim Townsend, and Joe Weems. Colors are by Richard Eisenhoff, and letters are by Dennis Heisler and Robin Spehair. So, yeah, there's a lot of people that work on these books. This was kind of the way that it was back in the day in the 90s with a lot of image books. They had bullpens. They had a lot of people that were sort of learning the craft alongside other veterans. So it's not surprising that you see so many names on a lot of these titles, but they do sort of tend to look very similar, surprisingly so, considering how many people were working on it. But again, these people were working alongside each other, you know, oftentimes in the same studio, and you're being trained and mentored by others. And so a lot of these image studios did have house styles back then. So now let me go ahead and dive into the issue here. I think the last time in the chronology, we talked about the 0.5 issue or the half issue from Wizard. This one opens up with an interesting poem. We see some kind of blonde woman with crazy hair, and I'm not exactly sure what this is about. Three who are one since the world began, three who watched it draw forth man. Three who watched man's magic anew, three who felt its essence split in two, three who felt a great weave start, three who call out to man's heart. Three who call new judges attend, three who are one as the world ends. So I'm assuming there's some kind of gods or something or other, clearly on Earth, and clearly there's a lot of magic involved. So as we turn to the first page of the story, we're in Santa Monica. We're outside a diner called Norn's. There's one waitress who's just getting off work, and she's waking up another, saying, "I'm about to go out. Ming, you should come and join us when you're ready." And they're in the back of the diner, apparently in the back room, maybe the break room. And as they walk out front, they find a man holding a knife, and all the patrons are dead, covered in blood. It's pretty brutal art, actually. We know that this figure who's killed all these people goes by the name of Hawk. We saw him in the first issue. He's holding a severed human head here, as I said, covered in blood. And this wasn't clear to me in the half issue, which is kind of strange because I believe that this number one issue was actually published first, but it's clear by his dialect and his vocabulary that he's Australian. So he notices the two girls walk up front from the back and says, good day, ladies. Sorry to spoil your plans, but one of you Sheilas must be the one I'm hunting because I killed everybody else in here, but I still sense that whoever I'm looking for is still alive." So the girls clearly are freaked out. This guy has killed everybody there. And Hawk says, "Yes, I feel it. The one I'm after is still alive and kicking. And that feeling that I get when I'm tracking somebody led me to this gourmet establishment. And now it looks like the hunt is over. And it's been fun, but I need to finish off the kill and complete my mission, basically." And he somehow creates a giant explosion with his knife. We see some lightning sort of crackle off of it, and then the entire diner explodes. He survives it, as does Ming. She's kind of thrown from the blast, and she's pretty freaked out. You know, she just saw everybody in the diner she worked at murdered. She just saw her friend Julie killed, and she sees this Hawk person come walking out of the flames, and he says, "Well, you must be the one I'm looking for because everybody else is dead and you survived it. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You must already have some power, some juju," he calls it, "because you were able to survive that explosion. So I'm actually going to let you run, because as much as I love killing, I love hunting even more. I love the chase. So you're going to run, and me and my furry mates, because all of a sudden he seems to have summoned these, I don't know, one of them sort of looks like a wolf, another looks like a mutated bulldog. I don't know, there must be some sort of hounds or demonic pets that he has. But anyway, he tells Ming, yeah, you're going to run, and we're going to chase you, and this is your chance. There's going to be no more chances after this, and I will catch you. But do try to give us some sport. So run, Ming does. I mean, you can't really blame her. And she heads down an alley that turns out to be a dead end. And as the animals that Hawk summoned start to attack her, she actually, through fear, I suppose, manifests even more of her power. And she holds one hand out to try to keep them at bay, screams out no. And all of a sudden, this green light comes out from her hand, and all of these pets, all of these hounds or whatever they are that were chasing her, fall dead. And not only that, birds that were in the area fall dead. We see a cockroach fall dead. We see leaves from trees that were close by fall dead. So she's obviously very surprised that she was able to do this. And she said, "Oh, I'm dead tired. What's going on? Everything is dead. Did I do that? Like, how did I do that? They were all dead in the restaurant. You know, Julie died as well." And then when she thinks of her friend, she starts to freak out again, saying, "Oh my God, he killed Julie. What's happening to me?" And she leaves the alley and manages to stay ahead of Hawk. When Hawk arrives in the alley, expecting Ming probably to be cornered there by his hounds, he realizes that everybody's dead, including these birds, and he's very surprised. He's like, wow, she doesn't just have a little bit of her power. She's running on full blast. And Blake, whoever that is going to have my hide over this. So we find out who Blake is pretty quickly, because all of a sudden he shows up. He gets apparently he has some sort of, Hawk has some sort of tattoo on his hand that's like some sort of communication device, and it starts to hum, almost as if Hawk summoned Blake by saying his name, but clearly not, because he says, "Whoa, speak of the devil, and he'll come calling." And so there's a little holographic projection of Hawk's, or Blake's head, rather, and he wants to know what the results are, what's the results of the hunt. And Hawk says, "Well, Mr. Blake, I ran into a bit of bad luck. She's Asian. She's about 20. She's wearing a waitress uniform, and she got away. But I'll track her down soon." And Hawk says, or Mr. Blake rather says, "I doubt that she just got away, right? And I doubt you're going to have her rounded up real soon, because we noticed that her personal energy just spiked to full avatar level 2 minutes ago. So that must have been when she manifested the power that killed all those living things in the alley." And then Blake says, "And you told me that you had tracked her to some restaurant and you were going to be able to kill her, and she wasn't at full power then." So Blake clearly knows Hawk well, and he says, "This isn't some deer hunt, Hawk. And you let her go for sport, didn't you?" And Hawk tries to interrupt him, saying, "Now listen, Mr. Blake." And he's like, "No, you listen. You're not welcome in this hunting party anymore. I'd rather some more worthy, more trustworthy associates go clean up your mess. So go do whatever it is you do, sniff animal droppings or whatever, but you're done." And Hawk's following orders says, "Yes, Mr. Blake." And he disappears. And the second half of that conversation, by the way, it looks like we're in some sort of library. We see in the background a lot of other, I'm going to say, subordinates wearing robes. And in fact, some of them appear to be using some sort of power of their mind to create this magical communication, because there are four of these robed figures sitting around what looks like some sort of shallow cauldron. And out of that shallow cauldron are these blue energy tentacles that kind of form into Hawk's head. So clearly some sort of magical communication. Beyond that, we see pillars. We see a lot of books. It looks similar to a library, perhaps. And this is Mr. Blake, whoever he might be, clearly is a powerful guy. He has servants. He has these people that have magical powers working for him, part of some society, or we're not just sure at this point, but that is what it appears to be. So as the communication ends, another one of his employees, I guess you'd say, shows up. It's Michael Royal, I believe his name is. We didn't see him show up in the half issue, but in the back matter of the half issue, we saw that he was called the enemy of the heroic avatars. And so, as I said, he shows up as the conversation with Hawk ends, and he tells Blake that, you know, maybe it's good that Ming fully formed into this avatar, and it might actually be foolish to kill her now. And Blake's like, well, what do you mean? You have a better idea? And Royal says, yeah, what if we send a squad of golems to capture her? If she can be turned to your way of thinking, then it's adding to your power. And Blake says, well, and if she can't be turned? And Royal says, well, we capture her, right? We capture her and we find out if she can be turned. And if she can't, then we kill her. And he goes on to say, my organization is totally available to you. We have magical resources and we can get this done. So Blake agrees, says, okay, Royal, but it's your mess. And never doubt who's really in charge here. So Ming has headed to the Santa Monica Promenade, and she's still running, thinking that she's going to die, just like Julie. And through the exposition, we understand that she came to this country in a dark rat-infested ship with her parents. Her parents didn't survive the journey, but she did survive it. And so there's something in her there's some strength in her, even if it's hidden most of the time. And she thinks she's going to be safe by being around crowds and people. And she's still trying to think about what happened in the alley. It made her feel so tired, but at the same time, it was energy that came from her, and she's trying to understand it. And as she starts to feel this tiredness descend on her, she starts to think, well, you know what? Maybe that's what it is. None of this is even real. I'm actually still asleep in the back room of the diner, and I just need to wake up from this nightmare. And as she says that, all of a sudden, there is, in the middle of a crowd, this glowing light suspended in midair, which eventually enlarges to a portal, and these golems appear out of it, and they look like, it's almost hard to explain them. They look like sort of medieval knights in armor in a way, but they have these arms that have like three pincers on them. They're like cylindrical hands that just have, instead of fingers, whatever, like I said, it's three pincers. So it's an interesting look. I mean, their faces, they don't have any features. It just looks like a shield with a sort of a cross on it. Very, very 90s art. I mean, all this art is very, very 90s. If there's anywhere the art shines, it's the color work, but I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute here. So these apparently are the golems, and they spot the target right away. They spot Ming right away, and they try to capture her. As Ming continues to run, she bumps into somebody, and it turns out that somebody is Georgie, who we saw as one of the avatars, the leader of the heroic avatars. And he's there along with Marie Eisenov, Luis Benitez, and Nasir, who are, again, the heroic avatars, these people that fought against Hawk in the first issue. We really, at this point, don't know that much about them, but they do say, lady, we need to get you to asylum pronto, and the rest of us will handle these golems. So they do indeed attack the golems, and they must be a lot more powerful than the golems, because they dispatch them relatively quickly and easily, at least the first two. And back at the Athenium Thurgical, apparently that's the base where Blake is, his headquarters that we saw earlier with all the books and the acolytes and such, he wants to know. He asks Royal, okay, so where's my new avatar? You sent your golems to capture her, and she should be here by now. And Royal says, well, two of the golem units, two of the four that we already sent, are already down, and the other operators are almost comatose. Apparently, there's nothing in those golems. It's more of a traditional golem When you think about like the Jewish folklore, where it's this massive behemoth made out of clay that somebody projects their mind into and controls it. So Royal even says that the psychic shock of their bodies re-merging with their souls back here was enormous, and it seems like they've encountered an enemy contingent. And Royal then apologizes. He says, I'm sorry for my lack of good judgment. What are your orders? So Royal apparently believes the cause to be lost already now that these other heroic avatars have showed up. So Blake says, you know, I won't be needing you anymore or your might. Tell the rest of my associates to prepare for battle. This all ends tonight. So apparently there's some sort of war going on between some of these avatars. So meanwhile, back at the outdoor mall where the battle is taking place, we see Luis Benitez, who's able to basically pull in minerals from around him and create this kind of rocky armor. He engages the third golem, and he actually defeats it relatively quickly. He even rips off one of his one of the golem's arms and kind of incorporates it into himself. We see that the fourth golem actually tracks down Ming as she's kind of running through a back alley trying to escape, and she's scared. She doesn't understand what's going on. It's like it's all happening again. Everybody's going to die, just like they did at the diner. And we see the fourth golem actually capture her. And as this golem lifts her in the air, we see the fourth of the heroic avatars arrive to save her, Nasir, Ramat Nasir, who manages to free Ming from the golem. And even though he's defeated it and it's laying there on the ground, Ramat does say, can you walk? We need to hurry. We have to get you to asylum now. So there's that word again, asylum. And so Nasir sees another portal start to form, and he's like, okay, we got to go because this is something I can't handle alone. We need asylum. And so they run off down the street, and they see a nightclub that's actually called The Asylum. And Ming says, asylum is a club? And as they go inside, we see there's a band on stage. There's plenty of people dancing. And Nasir says, this is not what it seems. We'll be safe here, but we need... And before he can finish his sentence, there's a big explosion. And he shields Ming with his body as best he can. And as he turns, he says, Blake. And we see that Blake has shown up. He's no longer wearing the white suit that we saw him in before. Now he looks to be dressed in some battle armor with a cape and gauntlets. And he has what looks to be sort of a thin, crazed follower in some sort of battle armor over his right shoulder. He has a woman wearing some skimpy bikini-like battle armor over his left shoulder. And then directly behind him, he has a real hulking-looking man carrying a double-edged battle axe, wearing some armor as well. His face covered with this nearly full face mask that has tusks, what looks like tusks coming out of it. So as Blake strides toward them, he says, Nasir, I believe you have something I want. I'm here to take it along with your worthless goddamn life, and more secrets to be revealed next issue. So it's an interesting start for Arcanum. Again, I know very, very little about this story, basically what I read in the half issue, which really didn't tell me much. I didn't read quite all the back matter. I know that these beings are apparently very powerful. They're called avatars. Obviously, there are different factions and they're at war. I don't know if they're immortal in a way, or they're reincarnating, because again, Ming apparently is one of these avatars and doesn't know it. So I get the feeling that it's something that's sort of passed down and manifests itself at some point as they reach adulthood. And again, they're being reincarnated and they just don't realize it. But I'm sure there's a lot more to be explored. It seems like the powers are magical based, but they do manifest themselves differently for different avatars. So they end up with different power sets. So it's interesting enough that I definitely want to keep reading and find out where it goes from here. It's not the best dialogue. It's not the best scripted series I've ever read, but again, it's from 1997, and of course the late 90s are not known for the high quality of their comics, and the art, it's Brandon Peterson, and to me Brandon Peterson art is good, right? Like, I think about his work at CrossGen, and it's really great. But this is much earlier in his career, and it's not quite as... it's not quite as smooth, is what I'll say. It's a little stiff, and it has a lot to do with kind of the poses that he's choosing and where he's putting the cameras around. The line work and the detail is still really, really good, but I just feel like the character acting, the choices he makes, where to put the camera, as I said, the poses and such aren't as good. The anatomy's still good, but everybody here just seems a little stiff. It's almost like if you were watching like stop motion animation, or if you were using like action figures as reference. I saw somebody on Twitter just talking about that the other day, and I can't remember who they were referring to. John Malin, maybe? And they were talking about the fact that they knew that Malin had used at one point action figures for reference. And the problem with that is, you know, their muscles don't move naturally, right? If you put an action figure and he has his hands down, the biceps and the muscles look a certain way. And if you bring those arms up over their head, the biceps and the muscles and such, they still look the same way because it's not a real person. It's an action figure, right? It doesn't change or move. And so if you're using that for reference, you know, even if it's an action figure, like a Spider-Man action figure that has like whatever, you know, 50 points of articulation, it's still not natural because the muscles don't change shape like they normally would with a real person. So I kind of feel like that's sort of the same situation here with Brandon Peterson. And it's not every panel, but there are a few panels where things just look a little wonky. So I know his art gets a lot better. I'm a Brandon Peterson fan. Like I said, that cross-gen work especially is really spectacular. I did mention the color work previously. Richard Eisenov, which is funny because the main female avatar, her name is Maria Eisenov. So I can only assume that Brandon Peterson named it after Richard Eisenov. But he does a great job with the colors. Even though this isn't necessarily a traditional superhero comic, the colors are very bright and vibrant, and it does give the art a chance to really jump off the page. And I think more than anything, the color work on this book is where it shines the most. It's not like this overtly mature comic either. You know, it's certainly not as bad as some of the 90s comics in terms of, you know, skimpy costumes. Obviously, there's a, you know, a severed head and a lot of blood in the first couple pages when Hawk kills everybody in the diner. But even the blood, it looks so fake and so cartoony that it's not like scary or disgusting or anything. Because again, it just looks so fake. So again, I'm not 100% sure where the story is going, but it is what's up next in the chronology. And I think there are 8 issues in this series before it got canceled. So it's definitely an easy way to know what's coming up in the chronology. We'll be covering this to the end. So I guess that's all I have to say about this issue. Again, there's not a lot to the story. There's still many more questions than we have answers. And this is a pretty fast-paced issue. Again, like a lot of 90s comics, a lot of splash pages and big panels, so it ends up being a really quick read. So that's it for the issue. Let me remind everybody what the Top Cow chronology is, if you're not familiar. Big fan of Top Cow, big fan of Matt Hawkins and Mark Silvestri and those guys over there, and I had discovered Top Cow and read a lot of the what they used to print under their Minotaur Press label, but now it's just kind of all under Top Cow. But I had never read like a lot of the classic Top Cow stuff, like Witchblade and the Darkness and things like that, sort of the artifact corner of the Top Cow universe, which is a big surprise to me, actually, when I stop and think about it, because I was such a huge Michael Turner fan and still am. And I even had this giant omnibus that had like issues 1 through 80 of Witchblade, but I had never read it. So when it came time to check it out and to really start diving into the Top Cow artifact universe, I was looking for a reading order, like what, you know, what order, like how does Witchblade and Darkness, how do they interact? Because I, you know, I'm a comic collector. I want to kind of read things in order. So when I did that, I stumbled across this reading order that was created by a user named Condor over at the Comic Vine website. And what was really unique about this reading order is it wasn't like a publishing order. It didn't tell me like, okay, this issue of Witchblade was published this month, read that first, and then read the Darkness issue that was published the same month, and then, you know, back and forth alternate this and that. No, this was a reading order that was based like in real time chronology. Like, these are the issues that happened the furthest back in time, you know, ancient Egypt or what have you, and you can read them, and this is where everything fits together. Here's where the Darkness issues go. Here's where these special one-shots go. Here's a Medieval Spawn Witchblade crossover. Here's a Tomb Raider, you know, whatever it might be, so that you could read it all and have it make sense, and you would eventually, you know, come up to modern times. And so I thought that was really, really great. Kudos to Condor for putting that together. And that's how the podcast got started. We started back with, we actually read Witchblade 1 through 6 first just for a foundation, and then we started at the beginning of that chronology. So that's the way the Top Cow chronology started. And it's a huge chronology, and obviously there's Top Cow still putting out books today, so the chronology continues to grow. I actually don't know if Condor is still working on it or not, because I haven't looked at the most recent version. There's like, it's broken down into three parts, and I'm still on part one. And I don't know if I'll ever finish it in my lifetime, because we don't always do chronology episodes on Thursdays. But that's just to give you an idea of what the chronology is, give you somewhat of an understanding. You can go to the show notes and find a link to the chronology, so you'll know what's coming up and what we've covered so far if you want to follow along. The other thing is that a lot of this is, especially early on, is a lot of 90s comics. So they're not hugely expensive, but they can be tough to find at times. I always suggest eBay. Some of the stuff, when it's Witchblade or Darkness, that kind of thing, it's been collected, and so you can easily find it in trade. Some of the more obscure stuff, or like the Tomb Raider stuff, Top Cow doesn't have the license for Tomb Raider anymore, so they can't reprint that Tomb Raider stuff. They can't even release it digitally. So that kind of stuff, you have to sort of track down the actual issues at a show or at a local comic shop or things like that, or eBay. But again, the stuff's not really that expensive. And if you're missing something, it's probably enough to listen to the episode. These aren't, you know, this isn't Watchmen. This isn't The Dark Knight Returns. It's fun. And it's, you know, 90s, and there's some nostalgia for it. And I think there has been some really good stories, actually. And I think as we come into the modern times and start reading a lot of the Ron Mars Artifact stuff, it'll get a lot better. But in the meantime, it's fun. Like I said, it's Top Cow. It's of its time. And some of it's really before its time. Like, a lot of the old Witchblade stuff stands up really, really well, actually. You know, despite Top Cow having this sort of reputation, people perceived it as this bad girl publisher, which was also kind of a trend in the 90s. It really wasn't, other than the fact that Sarah Pazzini, when she was the wielder of the Witchblade manifested itself in this like sexy costume. A lot of it is pretty forward thinking in terms of how it was a female protagonist, a female lead in the title, and she didn't like go and get herself captured all the time and then have to be rescued. You know, she wasn't like a Mary Sue either. So it was really strong writing, a lot of it by David Wall and Christina Z, and maybe because there was a female on the, you know, on the writing staff on the title, maybe that helped out. She made sure that it was a much more realistic character, and Sarah Pazzini's a very strong character. And again, in a lot of ways, Witchblade was ahead of its time. So anyway, like I said, there's a link to the chronology in the show notes. Really encourage you to go and check it out. You can, if you haven't been following along, you can go back, you can get caught up. As I said, a lot of the stuff you can find really cheaply, or at the very least, you'll know what's coming up for the next few episodes anyway. We're going to be talking Arcanum, and then we'll see. I don't even remember what comes after that, so I guess we'll learn that. I'll learn that along with you. But we have a few more issues of Arcanum, and as I said, I'm interested to find out just what the story is that Brandon Peterson is telling. Will it eventually get better? Will I feel like it was worth reading? Because again, it's not terrible, but it's kind of indicative of the sort of late 90s comics that people don't necessarily remember fondly. So I'll leave it at that. But again, great color work from Richard Eisenov, and an entertaining enough issue in its own right. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. The Comic Source is a member of the LRM Podcast Network, so when you visit the site, be sure to check out some of our other podcasts like Los Fanboys, our official movie and TV podcast hosted by Joseph Jammer Medina, Netflix and Chill, hosted by Nick and Carrie, covering a wide variety of film and television topics with Game of Thrones and Star Wars as particular favorites, and finally, Mike and Mark's Marvelous Adventures, as these two former athletes share their love of sports and geek culture by chatting about anything and everything sports and geek related. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.